Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 267th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of K. Barton Tools, and tonight I'm visiting with Joshua Klein of Morris & Tennant Magazine. And we're here to talk about their new issues and other happenings at Morris & Tennant HQ, I guess. So welcome to the show, Joshua.
Thank you. Thanks, Kyle.
It's great to have you back. I wanted to have you back sooner. as the magazine went out, but I'm glad we got you in at least after it was just issued.
I think
full transparency here, I have not received my copy yet, but it is in the mail. So
okay, is it because we lost it or
no, it was because I have been so busy and I saw the pre-orders and I missed on the pre-orders. I said, yeah, sure. Well, I'll order it. I got busy, and then of all things, I was at Highland Woodworking on their website ordering some stuff I could only get from them. I went, oh crap, I forgot to order Morris & Tennant. And you know, they had a little thing, hey, we got the new magazine, so I clicked on that, so I did that, so hopefully it'll be here in a day or so. I was hoping I got it before we recorded, but
well, I'll spoil all of the secrets for you, so don't worry.
Okay. Well, great, so I apologize about that, but before we get started, I thought I'd go through the web and some things of interest I saw. Power tool wise, just let everyone know, Laguna has introduced an updated line of table saws. This is their Fusion table saws. So anyone interested in table saws, might want to check those out. Looks like they got some from, you know, 1.5 horsepower, 3 different table saws. So, that they're introducing one, like I said, 1.5 horsepower, 110 volt, all the way up to a big one. It's a Fusion 1, Fusion 2, and Fusion 3. So anyway, anyone interested in table saws might want to check that out. And along that same line, as far as power tools go, Harvey is introducing their Champion bandsaw. Now, for those of y'all that have listened to the podcast for a while, Harvey is they're a Chinese manufacturer, but more on the higher end, and they sell a lot of equipment into Europe, and they just in the last couple of years came into the U.S. market. So this is a 15-inch bandsaw, and which is, you know, kind of unusual, a little bit bigger than a 14, but not quite as big as a 16. So it's in that mix. I think Powermatic and maybe a couple other folks offer a 15-inch bandsaw, but it looks to be fairly good. So and if you're in the market for a bandsaw, it's definitely worth checking out. And I believe Woodcraft carries their line of equipment and a few others out there. But it looks to be a pretty good bandsaw. And then next up, Joshua, I don't know if you have seen this, but Lee Valley is introducing a replica bevel square, and it's it's based on a design by a guy, Justice Trout, I believe. He was with the Stanley & Rule Company, and apparently he came up with this redesigned model, and it was never produced, and I guess they got a hold of the plans or schematics for this and decided to go ahead and produce it. So looks to be pretty neat. And at $59, it's not that bad. The only thing is they keep showing this being used more like a combination type rule, not like a bevel square. I mean, it looks like it locks in at 90 degrees, but I don't see them using it for any types of bevels, except the base of it does have a 45 degree, kind of like your combination square would. But anyway, I thought it was kind of interesting, though. I'd like to see one in person.
Yeah, but, definitely.
If you're, but you know, reproducing old tools. I always think that's kind of neat. And are you familiar, and I didn't put this in my show notes, but are you familiar with the little planes and chisels that Lee Valley makes, little miniature ones? They're really small.
I think only in passing. I'm not very familiar with it, but
yeah, I've only seen them at, you know, events and things and kind of played with them. But I thought it was funny that they've introduced a small honing guide, so you can actually use a honing guide for your super small planes.
Wow!
So nice, they have a miniature honing guide.
Does Annie of All Trades know about that, I wonder? Because I bet she'd be into that.
I bet she would. I'm sure she's seen them. They're kind of cute because, you know, they're little, these miniature hand planes, miniature chisels, and, you know, they're made and they work. I guess if you... I don't know. I guess they're a novelty item unless you did really small scale work and needed something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a tiny little plane that is for shaping the braces of the insides of guitar tops.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a little bit less than an inch long. It's quite small, but it's a pretty simple operation. It's not very complex. It's not like Marco Terenzi or something. It's very, very simple. So,
yeah. Yeah, well, that might be a market for them as luthiers, using those extremely small planes. And
yeah,
but yeah, they're kind of cute. And then the last thing I had to talk about was again back to combination squares and double squares. Is Woodpeckers is coming out with a one-time tool of adjustable squares, and they look pretty good, and they're fairly, you know, price-wise, they're fairly reasonable, about the same line as you would pay for a new Starrett combination square, and they got four sizes, or two sizes of each, two sizes of the combination square, a 12-inch and an 18-inch, and the same thing for their double squares is two sizes, a 6-inch and a 12-inch. So, and of course, you can buy them all or buy them one. But they're pretty unique. So anyone that's in the market for one, I would check them out. Now, these are a one-time tool. So I think order deadline is November 4th. So if you're listening to this after November 4th, you're out of luck. but it looks pretty interesting. You know, Woodpeckers is famous for their one-time tools. But that's about all I have seen out there of interest. Let's move on to what's in the shop. I'm running the solo, and it's kind of hard solo. So listeners, please forgive me. Both Sean and Diami couldn't be with us today, so running the solo is an interesting experience for me. But so what's in the shop? Joshua, what do you got working on in the shop?
I've been kind of doing a few different things. One is we've pretty far closed in this timber frame that we put up on our property here like 2 months ago now. So we have the frame closed in, and we can talk about that frame later, I'm sure. But so
it's on my list.
Yeah, we've kind of been doing carpentry to close that in.
Yeah.
And I'm actually the big project I'm working on is I'm writing a book about that frame and the whole experience we had. So doing a lot of like every autumn and winter, it's sort of like writing mode and just thinking a lot about those things. But, you know, I can't put tools down for too long. Mm-hmm. So I've actually been, I did some, my family always does this living history event in Maine.
Oh, cool. And
it's a 1790s, you know, historic interpretation of like a Maine logging camp. Mm-hmm. And so I always bring tools, and I usually bring my whole workbench and tool chest and kind of do the furniture making, cabinet making thing. But honestly, I was just a little tired. I just brought some, you know, a hatchet and some knives, and I was just carving spoons, which was fun to show, you know, splitting out crooked branches and how you would go about carving a spoon. So I got to do a few over the weekend, and that was fun. So, yeah, just small, simple projects.
Yeah.
Spoons are always great to flip in when you're, you know, you got like an hour and you're antsy and you just want to make some shavings. Right. You can, you know, make a spoon quick. It's fun.
Now, was that you on your on Morrison Tennant's Instagram post that did the little small bowl?
Oh, yeah. So yesterday I just made a little tray out of a chunk of cherry dried lumber that I had around. And I spent, I don't think it took longer than an hour to rough out this little tray. And it's got gouge marks, you know, textured inside. So it's heavily textured. So I wasn't agonizing over, you know, trying to make it all perfectly smooth. So yeah, it's kind of a look that I like. It looks like some of the rough pottery you see around. And so it's kind of fun to be able to do that in 1 hour. And I wiped a quick coat of shellac on it. And
I'm happy with it. So. Yeah, I saw that yesterday. And I was like, hey, that's pretty cool. And then I was, and then when you said it took you less than an hour, I was going, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's pretty fun, like, just to take that tiny little project. And, you know, I just had a gouge and a you know, back saw and pretty much that, and a chisel, you know, 1.5-inch chisel. That was pretty much all I used to make the entire thing. So it's kind of fun to do that.
Cool, cool. Well, for me in the shop, all I've been doing is got a few more orders I'm working on for my stretcher jig. I don't know if you're familiar with this Windsor stretcher jig I developed.
No, go ahead. Tell me about it.
Oh, well, for listeners, they've heard all about this.
One more time. Okay.
No, basically it's a jig. So it has a wooden base with a taper tenon on it, and that replaces one of your legs. And are you familiar with the direct drill method where you kind of have your drill bit on an extension and kind of, you know, So it's kind of like that method, but instead of, you know, just having to turn your leg a little bit to drill into it, what I'm doing is you take out one of your legs and you put this jig in there, and then this jig has what's called a rod end bearing on it, which allows your shaft extension to go through it. And so basically you're drilling directly in there. So there's no, all you have to know is the height of your mortise, and then you can shoot it from the other leg and drill straight into it. So,
Yeah.
It greatly simplifies the process. There's no angles. You don't have to take the leg out of the chair and risk drilling the mortise in the at the wrong angle. Don't, you know. Luckily, that's never happened to me, so I say. but, you know, it greatly simplifies it. So I developed that jig. So I've gotten a few more orders, and I'm working on doing that. And then I'm working on another jig that uses a similar technology of this rod end bearing, but it's actually for boring holes in a seat blank for legs and arm posts and spindles. So kind of works on the same concept for that. So I've been working on that and a couple other things. So that's basically what I've been doing in the shop.
Cool.
And all this happened when I was working on a Pete Galbert designed rocker. And I don't know if I'm ever going to get to finishing that rocker. I will someday. This has been about a 3-month tangent from that rocker. Just wait a minute. Let me work on this first. And so.
Oh, I see. So you're still making the jig to finish the chair.
Yeah. I made the jig to finish the chair.
Yeah. Okay. I got you.
And then, I said, hey, I might be able to sell this. And then I put it out there and people started buying it. So it's like, well, guess what? I'm a tool maker now, at least for the next few months.
Funny. Careful with that.
I know. And then that idea has led to a couple other ideas. So I need to see those through. And so eventually I'll get back to chair making. So
yeah, or you'll make so much money you can buy one of Pete's chairs.
I wish. I've talked to Pete about this, and apparently making tools for Windsor chair makers is not a road to riches either. Your market tends to be really small.
I see. Okay.
But it's fun, and I enjoy doing it. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's get back on what's going on with you now. Before we get started, anybody that's interested in finding out more about Joshua Klein, visit Lost Art Press and do a search for him on their blog for their Meet the Author series, because I saw this when it came out, and I think it's one of the longest ones that they've done.
That's pretty long, yeah. Yeah. Pretty detailed.
Yeah, it is detailed. So you everything from where you grew up to what led you to where you are now and what you're doing in Maine. So yeah. It's quite fascinating. You've definitely had an interesting life so far, and it can only continue to be interesting. I can imagine with everything that's going on.
Yeah, I feel like it's just a big journey, just trying to keep my head on straight and just do good work and do work I'm passionate about. So I've been led down some interesting paths. So
exactly. So tell us now, one of the reasons we want to have you on is talk a little bit about issue 7 of Mortise and Tenon magazine that was just released. So tell us a little bit about issue 7 and kind of the highlights. And you said you were going to share some secrets too. So we want to.
I'll tell you all the typos we found after the printing. No, I'm just kidding.
Exactly. Do you have a few of those readers that come out on page 23, paragraph 4?
Yeah, they're all types out there. Yeah. We have a few, though. Although I will say, I think we're pretty good on typos. Now that I'm saying that out loud, we're probably going to start getting emails. But
yeah,
we don't catch many after the fact. So we work pretty hard right before it goes to the printer that week before. We just we're copy reading it. So I'm reading out loud, and Mike is reading along, and then we'll switch. And we're combing through it pretty hard. But issue 7 is we're just super excited about it. We just, you know, we are new in publishing relatively. And so every issue we're learning a lot and pushing harder and trying to do a better and better job. And we've gotten great feedback from our readers. They're excited, more excited about each issue. And so we see good things as we're developing. And so issue 7 is, we never have a conscious theme with any given issue, but things tend to emerge. And as we're, you know, it's not just a mishmash of random articles. Of course, we're, you know, sort of curating the content. We're getting articles and saying this will fit here, and we'll offset that with this kind of article and make sure we have a balance. And maybe it's subconscious or something. It sort of always ends up being some sort of unifying theme or thrust that runs through several of the articles. And the past few issues have been particularly that way. And this one's no exception. It's definitely like that. And so the unofficial theme that sort of emerged out of a lot of these is our relationship as woodworkers to nature, the natural world, and understanding the forest and the way that we interact with it. And also, that's the positive way of saying it. The negative way of saying it is in contrast to industrial production. And so that theme has come up in different issues or different articles in this issue. We interviewed Peter Lamb, who's a craftsman that's been working all his life with his hands, blacksmith, woodworker, leather worker. And so he was talking about this, what he was calling a partnership with nature. And he was a good friend of Bill Copperthwaite's, who the last issue episode I was on, I talked about Bill Copperthwaite and how instrumental he was in my thought process about the relationship of handcraft and life. So It was great to get Peter's thoughts about, you know, understanding natural materials and what working with natural materials can offer us. Something that any woodworker, you know, has tasted that, you know, they've seen that. It's different. It's a very different, you have to understand grain direction, and it teaches you about, teaches you a bunch of lessons about how to work the materials, but also it teaches you about life. And that's where Peter kind of goes with that too.
Cool. Yeah. I've heard his workshop is just amazing to visit.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's gorgeous. So, So Peter's article is called A Partnership with Nature, but many other articles unconsciously touch on that theme and pick that up. Jared Dahl wrote an article called The New Wood Culture. Jared and Barn the Spoon and Robin Wood, they've been talking about this wood culture renaissance, or what Jared calls the new wood culture. And so he wrote about, as this has been developing over the past few years, kind of his take on it now, today, where he sees it, and what it means. So the new wood culture is basically just understanding, incorporating more wooden objects into our lives. So people eating out of wooden bowls, eating with wooden spoons. Like my backpack is an ash pack basket. So it's a wooden backpack, basically. Wooden backpack and things like that. So cool. It's just part of understanding that in relationship to 21st century life. How can we bring more natural materials into our life? So,
yeah, it's a fascinating issue. I mean, there's a bunch of articles, on your blog. You kind of had a little excerpt from a lot of the major articles in this issue, and it's just fantastic. I mean, of course, the one that caught my eye is the Welsh stick chair article.
I mean, and so there's I think about that too. It'd be easy in a different issue. I would say it's about stick chairs. But folded into it, Kieran, this is Kieran Binney. The whole chair is designed around a crooked branch. That's what dictates the shape and the dimensions of the chair. So he talks about that quite a bit. So, again, it's this like this humanity and nature relationship and collaboration. So even in that article, it's just pretty cool to see how those themes just come up. But yeah, Kieran did an excellent job with that one.
Yeah, I saw that. That was fantastic. But you got a lot of interesting stuff. I think Michael, he has a article about freedom from vices, and I saw a little bit about that. I went, I can't wait to read that one either, because that looked fairly interesting.
Because I
know a lot of people are going, building all these fancy vices and stuff, and you got a real part of the community now kind of stepping away from using a bunch of work holding and say, hey, how did it used to be done? And I think here you're even looking at getting away from benches to some extent.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mike's article is not so much an argument that everybody ought to anything. It's more just saying what he does is he looks at he looks at three traditions, and he looks at the Western tradition, the Japanese tradition, and the First Nations, the Native American tradition, and looks at three of many traditions and just shows historically how this work was done. And this is even during the existence of vices. So it wasn't that vices weren't ever known.
Yeah.
But he was just showing, even in Western tradition, which you and I, of course, are familiar with, even in that situation, there was what Mike calls in the article, he thinks of it as free board woodworking. The board is free at all times. So you're planing just against a simple planing stop. It's not in a tail vise. It's not in a, some other kind of vise. It's just up against a stop. So you can take a pass and pick it up and flip it over and take another pass. So that the board is free at all times, or it's only held by your body somehow. And so that kind of thing, he talks about Japanese work. This is where you're picking up the workbench thing. Japanese woodworkers, don't really have a bench that we recognize as a bench as Westerners, because it's right. basically just a plank.
Yeah, and they use their body a lot to hold the work. Yeah.
Yeah. So Mike is talking about that, and he mm-hmm. spent time just talking with Andrew Hunter. And so Andrew contributed his thoughts to the article as well. And just understanding the Japanese culture as a floor-sitting culture. And so that's how their work holding evolved that way. And therefore, that's why a lot of their tools cut on the pull stroke instead of the push. And and then the native traditions, the Mokutagen and some other very simple tools, just a very simple kit, not thousands of tools that we think of, but just, you know, four basic tools and using your lap as your workbench, essentially. And so the Mokutagen is a crooked knife, and it's basically like kind of like a one-handed draw knife. So you're holding the stock with your non-dominant hand out far in front of you, and you're using this one-handed draw knife to shave it. And so he's just showing all these traditions for so long worked without vices. And so, of course, you know, the question we always ask ourselves when we're putting together an issue, we ask ourselves and every author, so what? So what? Who cares? Why would any of us care? Yeah. And that's what we're always asking ourselves as editors and authors, saying, okay, well, that's interesting that they did it that way. What relevance does that have to any of us today? So Mike talks about some of the benefits of being able to work that way, the versatility, the freedom to be able to adjust, and then it expands your skills as well to be able to work in this way. You're not bound to a particular bench with a particular vice. You can kind of work in all different situations. So, it was a really great article. Yeah, Mike's are always some of my favorite. Great job.
Yes, I can imagine. So how long does it take you to put an issue together? I assume y'all are already working on issue 8 at this point.
Yeah, issue 8 is underway. I mean, it's informally. But I mean, it's a little bit hard to say because we're always working on an issue. You know, we're always working on some writing. And we're always in communication with authors for now. You know, we have issue 9. Now we're booking up 4. And so we're just, there's always a lot of communication part of it. but the author deadline for issue 8 is January 1st. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we got some time. Mike and I were working on our articles. We finish ours a month earlier so that ours are out of the way before we get all our authors. So, basically, you know, we definitely spend at least, once we get articles from authors, we're spending a solid, you know, 2 or 3 months on different aspects of it. But there's always work in between to get ready to that stage. But our year is basically, half of our year is in the shop and half of our year is doing editorial work. So that's why we do it twice a year and not 4 times a year. Or we'd be on our computers today.
Exactly. Well, for those of y'all listeners that are interested in, if you don't already have issue 7, picking it up now, you can order it from your website or, you know, I'm getting mine from Highland Woodworking, but who are some other places you can get it from?
Yeah. In the U.S., just trying to think offhand, Lee Valley, also Lee Nielsen, Tools for Working Wood. I'm spacing. There are a few others as well that I'm blanking on right now.
And then you can also get a subscription too. Annual subscription, which will get you, you issue two issues a year. And I think that's a good discount too. And I probably just need to do that.
Yeah. End up buying every issue anyway. A little bit off the cover price and And the peace of mind to know you wouldn't miss out.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
It is. So, it is honestly just so much easier to have one product and then back issues instead of trying to. We used to do pre-orders for individual issues and it was just getting too many things. It's easier to subscribe. There we go. You'll get one. It's done.
Exactly, exactly. So, and you can do the subscription right on the Morrison Tenon magazine website, which. Yep. And so tell us a little bit about what else is going on now. You mentioned earlier about your new timber framed, what I think that's going to be a blacksmith shop, you said.
It's going to be serve several purposes, but blacksmith shop is the one that stands out to most people. It's also going to be partially a storage building. But that doesn't sound as cool.
But I'm really interested about the group that came and helped y'all out putting that up.
Yeah. So obviously it's a long story. It's a book mm-hmm. for it, so I'm working on it. Yeah. So I'll try to condense it. But there's this group, Charpentiers Sans Frontières, which is the Carpenters Without Borders. It's a French timber framing group. Mm-hmm. And Francois Calam put together this group in the early 2000s, somewhere about officially it started. And it's this volunteer group of passionate timber framers that travel around the world, primarily doing restoration on historic frames. So they're working on 15th century barns and castles and stuff like that. And so that's what they're normally doing. And they do it once or twice a year. Mm-hmm. And Mike and I learned about this group through our friend Will Lissack, who went to Romania with them and did a project. And he wrote about his trip in issue 4 of Mortise and Tenon. And right. We were just jaw dropped. We just said, this is the most amazing group, because basically everything they talked about, they kind of had this social justice angle on it, too. So they're doing a lot of work with refugees in Europe. And you know, their whole vision and their whole desire to get people, this group, they don't use any machines for their timber framing. It's all a hand tool thing. Mm-hmm. So much of what they do is so similar to our mission and our vision, but it's the timber framing version of our woodworking, of our furniture making. So
right. You're
just, oh my goodness, this group is awesome. You know, we got to meet these people someday. And I always thought, wow, wouldn't it be so cool to one day, like, go to Europe to one of these projects and just watch for a little bit. That'd be so cool.
Yeah.
And very long story short, they wanted to come to the US. They were hoping in 2019 to come to the US mm-hmm. because many of them haven't ever been to the States before. And they wanted to learn American timber framing. And long story short, they reached out to us. We connected. We talked about some ideas we had. And they said, yeah, we want to come out and build you a blacksmith shop. Whoa, ooh. Really? So, we basically shut down our entire year. All of the stuff we had planned, we just canceled and kind of said, okay, this is going to be intense. Because there was 35 carpenters came out.
Wow.
With spouses and other people that came to help. Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned something. So they wanted to come to the States to learn American timber framing. So is your blacksmith shop, for lack of a better word, is it a European timber framed, or is it more of an American timber framed? And how did that?
Well, yes. And that's what's cool about it is that it's both. The whole idea was that a lot of what CSF does is it's sort of a cultural exchange. Mm-hmm. So they bring in together all these different cultures. Very much, it's sort of a model for what Mike and I want to continue to do. You know, we're not Western-centric in our thinking. We're trying to get other cultures to contribute to mm-hmm. Mortise and Tenon. And that's what CSF is doing. So they're bringing people from all around the world. And their local axes and their traditions and their heritage. And we're all on a job site working together. You know, and so that's to us is just such a cool model. So the frame design is basically a New England typical frame. It's square rule joinery, which in Europe is not really done. And so they were coming out kind of scratching their heads, trying to understand why we're doing square rule or how to do that. Because the French method is scribing. Everything is scribed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were teaching the Americans how to do that.
Cool.
So like the scribing depends on they lay out all the timbers plumb to the ground stacking up the braces on top of the posts and the tie beams and everything. And then they use a plumb bob instead of a square to transfer their measurements onto. It's this totally radically different way of laying things out. So it was cool to see that. Cool to see that exchange.
That is fantastic. That kind of reminds me now. Who was it? There's a group of woodworkers in the U.S. will sometimes go down to Central and South America to help teach people there how to, you know, build furniture that they can sell locally. I think it is a Tim Rousseau, I believe, is involved in that group. But I know a number of folks like Curtis Buchanan has been down there to teach them how to build, you know, stools and chairs and, you know, how to make a, you know, spring pole lathe or, you know, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so, the name of that is escaping me, but I do know what you're talking about.
It's escaping me too. But it kind of reminds me of that exactly, but in the timber frame world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, so how long were they here in the States? I mean, did they just come to your place, or were they going?
I picked them up at the bus station and brought them back when they were done. So they were just out here for this project. They were here for about 11 days total.
Okay.
The build itself, the construction, was 8 days, and the raising was on the ninth day and, you know, half a day. And so it was amazing because what we're talking about is they showed up to a pile of logs. My friend John is a timber framer and a horse logger. So he logs.
Yeah. That was going to be my question is, I assume you had to get all the logs and stuff, ready to go for them.
Yeah. So John used his Suffolk Punch horses to log in his property. And then we had him brought over to my property. So when the European team showed up, they showed up to a big pile of logs.
Were horse-drawn logs?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've seen that in video, and it looks fairly interesting.
Oh, it was incredible, Kyle. It was so cool to see John at work. Mm-hmm. You know, he's such a gentle soul, and he has these Jay and Jackson, his two horses, and how strong they are and how skilled they are. They're just this really tight team. And he's not one of those, like, you know, yell at him and whip him and go. Yeah. It's like, hey, guys. And then they're just like right on it. You know, it's amazing. It's a beautiful thing. So, yeah. So the European team showed up to a huge pile of logs, 30 foot long, you know, 12 inch diameter, 13 inch diameter logs. And they pulled out their axes and said, let's do it. And so the entire thing was hand hewn, and all the joinery was hand cut and hand raised, the whole thing. There wasn't a machine on site. And so it was just pretty awesome to see because, you know, our whole world is hand tools, but at such a small scale. We're talking about a little table or, you know, a chair or something.
Yeah.
They're building buildings in 8 days, this group of them. And I just couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, as we had fun with Lee Valley's miniature chisels, they're probably having fun looking at our woodworking chisels.
Yeah, their chisels are.
You call that a chisel?
That's where it starts. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, wow. So when they left, so what did you have standing? So they raised the building. So I assume you still needed to do roofing and all of that kind of stuff to the building, or?
Yeah. So when they were finished, you know, we had the raising and we drove the pegs and we put the evergreen bough, the wedding bush, up on the ridge, and it was this big, you know, big party and music, and it was a great time. And then they that next morning we brought them back to the bus station to go down to Boston to get on the plane. And so then Mike and I turned to sheathing it and closing it in. And so right now it's sheathed, and we have 30-pound felt tar paper on the roof, and it's pretty well buttoned up to hold some snow for a little bit. And then in spring, we'll take the next step. So
cool. What type of roof are you going to put on it? I only ask you that because Diami would, because since his trade is in commercial roofing.
So I still haven't decided.
Okay.
We've narrowed it down to two options. One is slate,
Okay.
Or the other is riven split shingles or shakes, which we would do. So I haven't decided how we're going to do that yet, but I'm very interested in both. So
yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. Slate would be, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Now, so if you did the shingle roof, y'all would ride those yourselves.
Yeah, definitely. Those up.
Yeah, that's an article.
Gotta do something with that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's cool because, you know, it's, I remember I was actually just the other day looking again through one of the Roy Underhill books, mm-hmm. and he was showing split shingles. He had this really cool photograph of a split shingle and a sawn shingle, and they were submerged in water. And he was blowing on the end of it to, like, mm-hmm. blow bubbles in the water.
Yeah.
So you can see, you know, where the air is coming out.
Right.
And on the sawn one, there were bubbles coming out all over the surface because there were pores open all over the place. Yeah. And on the split one, it was only on the end grain, which says a lot about when you have a riven shingle and that's the top surface, there are no pores for water to get down into. It just sheds right off. So it's pretty cool.
That makes total sense, but something I've never thought of. But
yeah.
Wow. That's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so another thing that y'all had going on last few months was y'all did the mortise and tenon workshop. So how'd that go?
Oh my goodness. It was awesome. It was so cool. We had six students, most of them from the U.S.,
mm-hmm. but
we had some other people flying from other places, and so basically that was the work exchange model. So they worked with us for 2 days, worked on our property and helped some things here,
mm-hmm.
and then did 3 days of instruction. And so the primary project we had them help us with was the granite block foundation for this timber frame that we were going to be putting up in August. So they helped us do that foundation before CSF came up.
Oh, great.
That was cool. And it's, you know, I heard back from some of them and they were watching the build and they're, you know, obviously they had a big part in getting the foundation there. So it's just a cool way to do things, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's just
mm-hmm.
this side-by-side working with other people because it creates a bond like no other experience. So, it's really amazing people. It was a pretty cool thing. Everybody was camping here on site and we had bonfires in the evenings. And
how long was the workshop?
The total for the whole thing was 5 days. So it's between the 2 days of work and 3 days of they were building their projects. So it was sort of an open shop format.
Mm-hmm.
So they each had their own project they were working on. And it turns out they all wanted to do something radically different from each other. So we had one student, she was making a chair. So we had this whole green woodworking setup.
Yep.
We had someone reproducing Thoreau's writing desk out of white pine.
Yeah.
Someone else was doing a picture frame with molding. It was like all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it would be perhaps insane, but actually wasn't too bad. It was manageable trying to, Mike and I, we were back and forth, but it worked out. It was good.
Well, that's great. Well, if you decide to go the shingle route, I guess the next workshop will be arriving shingles.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's great. So what else is anything else upcoming at Mortise and Tenon you'd like to promote?
Yeah. So right now, basically, like I was saying, this year we kind of put the brakes on everything we were doing and just focused on getting ready for this timber frame project
mm-hmm.
because it really was like 5 months of work for this 1 week to happen. We fed them all and hosted them for this whole time, so it was a lot of work and prep. So we put everything else off, and so now that the dust is settled on that, we're diving right back into the projects we were going to do, and we have some other stuff we're catching up on. So I'm right now writing this book about the timber frame. The book is called Another Work is Possible. because that was the impression I got, that people thought this kind of work was impossible. You can't do that, but they showed it is possible. You can. So I'm doing that. And actually my brother, Sam, is a filmmaker, and he was here, and he filmed hours and hours and hours of footage of the whole thing. And so he's right now making a film documentary.
Oh, cool.
That's going to be sort of a complement to the book.
Yeah.
And between those two, I think, you know, he's been sending me stuff, that he's been doing, and I'm writing the book. And so I'm seeing the written word is valuable, and watching the video is valuable, and they're two different formats. And I feel like with the two, it's a pretty full representation of what it was here. So,
yeah.
And then Mike right now is, there are three of us working on three different projects. So Mike right now is editing our next instructional video. And it's about green woodworking, working from the woods. So it's, you know, that's where our minds have been. And so this issue 7 to be talking about that is pretty sweet. So all those things are on the near horizon. They're well underway. So you can expect to see those things soon.
And I can't let you go without also making a plug for your previous book, Hands Employed All Right, so about Jonathan Fisher. So that's a fabulous book.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. I think our last episode we had with you, we went into some detail on that book. But if you're at all interested in historic furniture making and learning about what that craft was like, I encourage you to pick up that book, and you can order that from various sources, including your website. So,
yeah. Yep.
That's been fantastic. Well, with that said, we'll move into our fortnightly beer choices. So for me, once again, it is St. Arnold's Oktoberfest, because it is that time of year. So it's a nice ale. And Joshua, do you have anything to recommend to us?
Yeah, I actually am just finishing my tea, because I just finished my beer earlier. I think actually probably the last episode, I'm sure I must have said that I was drinking a beer from Strong's Brewing just up the road. I think
that's
probably
what I said. Yes, I believe so.
And so, yeah, my friends Al and Mia, they have Strong Brewing Company. Mm-hmm. What did I just have? I had a Local Motion, which is their California Common. It's great beer. If you're in Maine, you should look for Strong Brewing.
Well, mine's about the same thing, because St. Arnold's is pretty much a local beer here. I think they do have a little bit of distribution, they do make a good Oktoberfest. I'm waiting for their Christmas ale to come out, because that's always a good choice too every year. We'll just have to wait on that. But Joshua, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
Our website is mortisantennenmag.com. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, a Google search would pull all that up. Through the website, you can find our Instagram page. Most of the social media I do and all that kind of stuff, I just, you know, once a day I put something on Instagram. So that's sort of the steady stream of what we're up to, and you can see that there. On our Instagram feed, you could go back and see some of those pictures, the timber frame and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, you get some neat stuff out there. I think there's even a couple of videos and whatnot on that. So yeah, I recommend that. I mean that, I'm not sure I would ever have the inclination to do any timber framing on my own, but I sure dig watching it.
Yeah.
Well, and learning about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing to see the proficiency. You'd think like, oh, wow, hand hewing that's going to take forever. Right. If it wasn't, like within an hour, I saw these squared up timbers being stacked off to the side. I'm like, what in the world? That's amazing. That's so awesome.
Yeah, I did see Roy Underhill one time at one of the Woodworking in Americas hew a log on a stage. Mm-hmm. And he had It was elevated. It's in a like a conference room, but they had this, you know, elevated stage that, you know, was probably great for speaking, but I'm not sure they wanted a log hewed on it. Yeah. And then Roy Underhill took this log and put it on top of saw benches. And then he stood on the saw benches on top of the stage and was hewing this log. And we're all going, this whole thing's going to collapse.
Oh, my goodness.
Going, this is the last we'll ever see of Roy. But no, but it went fine, of course. But
yeah.
But the whole thing is, you know, just shaking back and forth. But, you know, I was impressed because he was able to, you know, to make this log four square while entertaining and talking and, you know, within, you know, probably 30, 40 minutes. And I can imagine if you were just concentrating on doing that, yeah, it's a lot quicker than you think it would be.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
So it is amazing. Well, everyone can always find me on Instagram at barton.kyle. And that just about wraps it up for this show. So if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show. Wherever you get your podcast, just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. Then you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes. And thanks again for listening to the show. And be sure to visit us at modernwoodworkersassociation.com. And you can follow us at MWA on Twitter and on Instagram at MWA_podcast. And the best thing you can do is tell a friend, because word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion. So thanks again.